Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the second hour, Frank Sherwin will join us. We're going to talk about this week's meeting in St. Louis of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, but the subject was evolution. Is it true that if a parent comes to a school teacher and says, I don't want my child being taught evolution as though it were a fact, that is religious pressure being brought to bear in our public schools and infringement of academic freedom and things like that, or the freedom of speech, or of standing in the way of teaching good science? We'll talk about that here for the next 25 minutes. Then Marcia Montenegro joins us. What is goth culture? Is it just a fashion statement? Is it satanic? Does it have anything to do with vampires? Marcia has written an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled The World According to Goth, and we'll talk about goth culture. In the third hour of the program, we got two things lined up for you. First of all, we're going to be talking in that third hour with Karen Malik. According to the latest cancer-related death reports, men's numbers for cancer-related deaths have gone down. That's good news. Women's have gone up. Is there an explanation? Karen thinks she has one. We'll talk about that. And then in the last half hour of the program, some audio, among other things, from the National Religious Broadcasters that was being held in Dallas, their convention in Dallas. Lots of subjects being discussed there, and President Bush addressed, at least via videotape, the National Religious Broadcasters Convention in Dallas. We'll play all that for you and get your response during open lines in the last half hour of the program. Frank Sherwin is a biologist for the Institute for Creation Research based in Santee, California, and he joins us to talk about this meeting here in St. Louis of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Frank, welcome back.
Thanks so much. It's good to be back again.
Let's deal with the question of that comes up again and again in the newspaper articles surrounding this meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and pretty much what's coming from the teachers who feel like they are getting religious pressure in their classroom. A parent comes to a teacher, you know, early in the school year and says, I really wish that you wouldn't teach my kid evolution as a fact. Some parents might even say, I would hope that in science class you wouldn't teach my kid evolution at all. Is that religious pressure in the classroom?
Well, first of all, of course, we have to define what we mean by evolution. Now, there's two kinds of science. There's origin science, or otherwise known as historical science, and then there's also empirical science. So when it comes to the origin of species, that is, the origin of plants, animals, and people, that's what we call macroevolution, and teachers sometimes teach macroevolution, the origin of the various groups of animals and people, as a fact. The fact is, however, nobody has ever observed that to occur. Science means observation. But the same thing goes for creation. But right now, I don't want to talk so much about creation. I want to get back to your question. Basically, the issue is, there is minor variation that does occur, the minor variation that we see in bacteria, the minor variation we see with dog breeding, the minor variation with the various breeds of birds, like Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands. But this kind of minor variation has nothing to do with the origin of the species. So when I used to teach college at Pensacola Christian College, I taught my students evolution because, of course, my students who were pre-med had to take the MCATs, a very detailed examination prior to going to med school, and unfortunately so much of the MCATs had to do with evolution. So I necessarily had to teach my students evolution.
Okay, so that's the position I would take with a teacher, which is, look, you got to teach my kid at all because, first of all, don't teach it as a fact, but do teach it as a theory. But when you do, teach it as you would teach anything else. I do want my children to know what evolution is. I think hiding that from them probably does more harm than good.
Right.
And I can correct things at home, and
yeah,
I can answer questions at home.
And let me just say this. I am in contact with an evolutionist up in the Dakotas, and he was amazed to find out that the Institute for Creation Research, the organization I represent, is not opposed to evolution being taught in American public schools. We are all in favor of having evolution taught in American public schools, but not the origin science, that is, the origin of plants, animals, animals and people, taught as a fact, that is not empirical. You cannot measure that. So by all means, let's go ahead and continue to teach evolution in public schools, but at the same time, let the student hear an alternative, an extra-biblical alternative to evolution, and also let the student hear the serious problems associated with evolution as well.
Okay, that extra-biblical alternative has come to us in the form of ID, or intelligent design.
That is correct.
Respond, if you would, to the now very common contention. It's made in an op-ed piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch from this last week, and it's made elsewhere in the news coverage of the meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, that intelligent design is, number one, not science, and number two, what it really is simply creationism disguised as science.
And exactly the same thing could be said about neo-Darwinism. The idea that says that fish came from invertebrates or that people came from an ape-like ancestor is not science. And the fact is that the teaching, when a teacher stands up before the students in a taxpayer-paid public school setting, puts their finger in the air and says, all fish came from an invertebrate, that is a non-vertebrate ancestor, that's teaching macroevolution as a fact. And as a matter of fact, the American atheists just love that kind of teaching, because if ID is bringing creationism through the back door of American public school, then the way evolution is taught right now is bringing atheism right in through the front door of American public schools.
Someone would say, well, atheism is neutral.
No, atheism is just as pointed, just as dogmatic as, say, anybody who is an ID proponent.
Can you explain the apparent desperation on the part of macroevolution proponents, especially in the educational community, over ID? They didn't seem to get this worried about, people who believed in creation, or even the occasional parent saying, don't teach my kid evolution.
Uh-huh.
But when ID actually starts to make some inroads into the classroom or into the textbooks, you would think that they were trying to outlaw the teaching of evolution.
Outlaw the teaching of evolution. Oh, right. And the ID proponents, and of course we at ICR go a step further than ID by identifying who that creator is. We make no bones about that, but of course we do not say that you should teach that as a fact in American public schools. So basically the reason why ID is becoming such a threat to evolutionism, and I like to call it evolutionism with an ISM at the end, is because ID simply says, look, let's go where the evidence leads. If the evidence shows that things look like they're designed, there shouldn't be anything in science to prohibit us from going down that road and making that investigation. I think it's interesting that Hunn and Townsend, in their St. Louis Post-Dispatch article, said, with the fervor of preachers and the drive of generals. In other words, they really are making the evolutionist out to look like that this is an evangelistic outreach to nail down evolution as a fact.
There has been another objection I'd like your reaction to, and that is, and it was made very recently here in St. Louis by, I think, one of the professors at the medical school at Washington University.
Uh-huh.
He said, look, ID is a problem for this reason. What it does is it presents a theory that is alternate to macroevolution, and macroevolution is simply the basis for all modern biological sciences. We couldn't teach biology or anatomy without it.
That is an absolutely false statement, totally false, because macroevolution discusses the origin of the species, where plants, animals, and people came from originally, which is not empirical. I taught for 9 years, I taught human anatomy and physiology on the college level to pre-med and nursing majors. I never even made a nod toward Darwinian evolution, and my students were going to medical school. My students, not all of them, of course, but they were going to medical school. They were going into nursing programs. There's absolutely no need to mention evolution at all when teaching, especially anything having to do with human medicine.
Frank Sherwin is our guest. He's a biologist for the Institute for Creation Research. They're based in Santee, California. We're talking about this week's meeting in St. Louis of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address you can use for questions and comments as well. We'll get that here in real time in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Just to put a point on something you just said there, Frank, biology can be taught, anatomy can be taught, without reference to macroevolution, to that that teaching of evolution that deals with ultimate origins.
Correct.
So what do you deal with then, or do you not even address origins at all?
Well, you know, it depends on the instructor and all, but certainly we all have our biases. We all have our worldviews. My worldview is based upon Scripture. I believe that in the beginning God created. Certainly when we go to the fossil record, we find that plants have always been plants, animals have always been animals. For example, dinosaurs have always been dinosaurs, clams and trilobites have always been clams and trilobites. There is not that fine gradation that evolution theory demands between one major kind of plant or animal into something completely different. And so I would teach, of course, my human anatomy and physiology class to my students. In general biology, I would teach evolutionary ideas because, of course, as I'd mentioned earlier, the students had to take the MCATs, which are just full of evolutionary ideas.
How would you respond to someone who says, look, you're advocating the teaching of creation in our grade schools, high schools, colleges, medical schools?
Absolutely false. I could teach an alternative to macroevolution without ever mentioning a single Bible verse, without mentioning God, Christ, the Bible. I could easily teach, for example, that a species of plants and animals or basic kinds of plants and animals appear abruptly, fully formed in the fossil record, as indeed they do. That's not teaching creation. And we could also teach extra-biblical origin accounts, such as what we see with ID, so there could be no mention of a creator, nothing to get the so-called civil libertarians up in arms.
Someone might say, look, at least in Pennsylvania, in Dover, Pennsylvania, and in Georgia, this issue has been answered by the courts. In fact, there was a judge who just said intelligent design is not science, and that's good enough for me. How would you respond?
Yeah, well, of course, that's a judge who has had no formal training in science, who I think has made his bias very, very clear. If you read the whole decision that Judge Jones III made, he's very clearly coming down on in favor of an atheistic evolutionary interpretation. The fact is, intelligent design does not mention at any turn at all. They never mention creation. They never mention a creator. Again, as I said earlier, they never mention anything that would cause the alleged civil libertarians to get all upset. And so I think it's a double standard by the secular scientific community. They get all upset about intelligent design, even though the Bible's never mentioned. But at the same time, they're teaching macroevolution as a fact, that people came from fish, basically, billions of years ago, which is exactly in keeping with what the atheists want to hear and want our impressionable young people to hear using our taxpayer dollars.
Now, I want to come back to the classroom there again with the kids. I mean, they are being, I've looked at textbooks from that are used in public schools. I've also looked at textbooks that are also used in parochial schools sometimes. How, in real practical kind of down-to-earth way, how do you introduce the subject, or do you avoid the subject of origins altogether?
Well, in what surrounding? In a public school or a Christian school?
Well, let's just talk about the public school, that
okay.
Environment there. How do you introduce or do you avoid altogether the issue of origins when it comes to life?
Well, of course, you know, it's difficult to ask because you have to know the tenor. You have to know the political climate. You have to know the school board and the cross-section of the students that you're addressing. And you almost have to take that in a case-by-case basis. But in this free marketplace of ideas called American public education using our tax dollars, I think it's good for the student to understand that there is, and we can use the word extra-biblical alternative, to this bizarre, unscientific idea that says that people came from bacteria. That's what evolution says. It says bacteria came from non-living or organic molecules, and that the bacteria then slowly through the alleged billions of years of time became people. That's a religious idea. That's not science. And so students should not only hear the problems associated with that bizarre progression from bacteria to people, but also that there is an extra-biblical alternative to this idea.
Your response to this, it comes from an opinion piece that appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch yesterday.
Uh-huh.
The title, Teaching Evolution, Believe It or Not, near the end, this paragraph. In the 150 years since the theory of evolution was first put forth, it has predicted scores of future discoveries, everything from the existence of DNA to the remarkable similarity of genetic material from fruit flies to humans.
Yeah. The discovery of DNA had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with bowing before the altar of Darwin. DNA is simply looking in the nucleus of a cell, finding a darkly stained molecule, which turned out to be deoxyribonucleic acid. How evolution came into play on that discovery is completely disjointed. There's no connection to be made. Furthermore, certainly DNA is a universal molecule, but it doesn't necessarily imply a universal common ancestor. But I would maintain with my bias, just as the evolutionist has their bias, my bias says it means a common designer.
I've noticed this, and other guests we've talked with on this subject have also noticed it, and that is up until ID came to, up until Dembski wrote his book and people started understanding what ID is all about, the evolutionist was very comfortable using the term designed.
Yeah.
They would talk about, well, this molecule is designed, or this protein is designed, or this organ is designed, or this body system is designed. Design implies a designer.
Right.
Rather than simply saying, if they were thorough and consistent, saying this body system has evolved to, rather than designed. You expect them to curtail their use of that particular verb?
Well, the D word, as I call it, design, has always been kind of a knee-jerk reaction to some of the more secular scientists, some of the scientists that have this commitment to evolutionary naturalism. And so they basically, for decades, have been eschewing the D word, design, in favor of another word, adaptation. So they like to say that this organ, this system, this structure is adapted for its particular ecological environment. But we as creation scientists also use the word adapted, but of course we are not adverse from using the word design as well. But certainly I would agree with you, within the last decade, the word design is being avoided more and more by the secular community, because just as creation means a creator, design means a designer. If the universe looks tailor-made, there just might be a tailor.
Another response to another paragraph from the opinion piece in yesterday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Teaching Evolution, Believe It or Not. In his State of the Union address, President George W. Bush made a point of the need for better science and math education. If he really means that, as we hope he does, he needs to get the message that his base on the Christian right, he needs to get the message to his base on the Christian right, who are attacking evolution in the classroom and legislatures across the country. We've come to a sorry pass when American scientists and science teachers have to waste their time on such claptrap. Your response?
Yeah, okay. My response is, again, we'd have to define what we mean by evolution, whether we mean minor variation, which is basically adaptation, which has nothing to do with the origin of species. And, of course, if there's a religious right, then there's also a pagan left. And so, again, it all has to do with an individual's worldview. The fact of the matter is that those who are Christians in this country, who see their tax dollars being used to teach impressionable young people that they came from bacteria, that's going to stop. And if it means that we have to diplomatically address the teachers and the school boards, yes, and even the courts, we will do so. But this bizarre, unscientific idea that says that people came from bacteria, that has got to be addressed. I'm not using the C word, censorship, but I am saying two things. We can teach an extra-biblical alternative, and number two, we can teach the serious problems involved with this idea that says that people came from bacteria.
So ideally, do you see macroevolution and ID being presented as two opposing alternatives in the classroom in most cases?
I think that it's going to be probably a long way off as liberal judges like Judge Jones III consistently comes down on the side of the atheists, the materialistic humanists, however you want to term it. But again, you know, we are not going to sit idly by while our tax dollars are being wasted on this bizarre teaching. And again, you know, the evolutionists are running scared. They have to have this special rally. It's a pep rally to bolster them each other and assure each other that macroevolution is a fact. Here's what I would say as a representative of ICR out here in California. Let the evolutionists simply list 10 to 20 compelling empirical facts for macroevolution. Then they can forego these pep rallies in St. Louis and other places, and they can forego using litigation. I think it's interesting that they've turned to litigation, to suing school boards and suing individuals who question evolution. Why waste taxpayer dollars doing that, going through the courts, when all they have to do is list compelling empirical evidence in favor of macroevolution?
Does such evidence exist?
No evidence exists, which is why the Institute for Creation Research exists. You know, if they could list 20 compelling empirical evidences for macroevolution, then ICR would close its doors.
Someone says, and I think this is the thrust of kind of the opinion pieces in the paper as they've dealt with this meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and it seems to also be the thrust of that meeting's tenor as well. If we don't teach evolution to our kids are going to lose this great international race in science education.
No, I'm sorry to laugh, but I mean, that is so ridiculous. I have taught for years biology at the college level, and other than just mentioning some evolution in passing so that my students can pass the MCAT exams, which are just absolutely shot through with evolution, you can do perfectly well teaching the Krebs cycle, teaching mitosis and meiosis, teaching all facets of human physiology without ever once mentioning evolution. Evolution is complete. It's excess baggage and doesn't even need to be addressed in order for a student to have a sharp working knowledge of the biological sciences.
ICR.org is the website address for the Institute for Creation Research, ICR.org. Frank Sherwin is a biologist for the Institute for Creation Research. They're based in Santee, California. The website address again, ICR.org. And Frank, thank you for being our guest.
Well, I sure do appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to speak to the folks there in St. Louis. I hope I can do it again.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend time talking about Goth. If you don't know what Goth is, you haven't seen Goth, but once you've seen it, you won't forget it. It's a whole culture. It's a fashion. It is a mindset, maybe even a worldview. So what worldview is it? How serious should you take it if your kid comes home with the hair dyed black, all black clothes, maybe a piercing or two, lots of mascara, boy or girl, and maybe a little black lipstick as well? What role does music play in the Goth culture, and where did it all come from in the first place? We'll answer all those questions, including the biggest concern many Christians have is it satanic? Is it a fascination with death? Marcia Montenegro of Cana, Christian Answers for the New Age, and author of a story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled The World According to Goth, will be our guest right after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Dr. Carl Fakencher on the Center of Seminary Life at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Certainly, we would begin by expressing our strong commitment to the Scriptures and the Lutheran Confessions. Everything that we do here is gathered around God's Word, whether that is a matter of our daily worship in the chapel or the prayer life that is a part of our activity together. The classes themselves are always focused on proclaiming Christ as well. I think another very important aspect of our seminary that makes us unique is the relationship between the faculty and the students. And of course, always it's based on our shared faith in Christ Jesus.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, or to schedule an on-campus visit, call 1-800-481-2155. 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. The fallout from Danish cartoons portraying Mohammed continues. A coalition of Muslim nations is asking the United Nations to prevent member countries from offending religions. Should the UN get into the business of policing freedom of expression? Pete Wynn has more.
The Organization of the Islamic Conference, a 57-member Muslim voting bloc, has asked the United Nations to take measures against what they call Islamophobia. Thomas Jacobson of Focus on the Family Action.
What the Arab nations are asking the UN to do is to protect them from any criticism against their religion, and that is not something that the UN should do.
The OIC is asking for a UN declaration prohibiting the, quote, defamation of all prophets and faiths, end quote.
They should not be suppressing human rights. They were formed to protect and preserve human rights and to encourage countries to do the same.
Sources say there's little chance the UN will adopt all the Islamic demands, which include a new definition of freedom of speech against religions. Jared Leland of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty.
I doubt that the United States would sign an international agreement binding them to something that in essence would place a burden or restrict First Amendment rights over here.
Waleed Faris, author of Future Jihad, says making a theological issue political will have fallout.
If we open that Pandora box, then all religious groups are going to come and transform all legal systems, including international law, into an arena of battles.
He calls the current battle at the UN a moment of truth. For Family News in Focus, I'm Pete Wynn.
The OIC also wants the European Union to adopt a new code of ethics for European media. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. I'd like to invite our KFUO listeners to join us at Family Shield's dinner and silent auction at the Holiday Inn on Friday, March 3rd. The program includes a dramatic musical reenactment by Reverend James Likens. He'll portray the centurion soldier who helped nail Jesus to the cross. To register or learn more, call 314-772-6070.
Are the visions and oracles found in the Old Testament book of Ezekiel relevant to God's people today? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can get more information about this commentary on our website, issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel, our February Book of the Month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're halfway through the program today. We're turning our attention to the issue of Goth. Now, if you've seen it, you may not have known what to call it, but if you've seen it, then you probably have seen as much as anyone has of the goth culture, usually kids. It is a little sad when you see the adults dressed this way, but usually the kids, pale faces, dark eyes, dark lips, dark hair, dark clothes, maybe some piercings, maybe not, and the music, very dark, maybe the culture itself, images of death, images of, again, darkness, decay. What is goth culture? Where did it come from? And why, if at all, should Christians be concerned? Marcia Montenegro joins us. She's a former astrologist, founder of Cana Christian Answers for the New Age, and author of the cover story for the latest Christian research journal titled The World According to Goth. Marcia, welcome back.
Hello, Todd. Nice to be back.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Okay, the picture that people get in their mind when they think goth is the one I painted before. What is the worldview that informs all of that that we described, the music, the look, the outlook on the world?
Well, I would say the basic worldview is that society is superficial. Mainstream culture is superficial and shallow and does not want to look at things that are dark, that are perhaps a little scary, that are unsettling, such as death and decay. And therefore, by not looking at these things, they've made them ugly when actually there is beauty that can be seen in them. And I would say that's a view that most goths would share. Of course, you're not going to find, monolithic views among all goths. And there are different types of goths, but that tends to be an overall theme in the goth culture.
Someone says, look, I've seen this before. I've seen it in different forms, and the hairstyles change, and the clothes change, and the music change. But this is just good old-fashioned American teenage nonconformity.
I would have to disagree with that. I think part of it, it definitely may draw, nonconformists. But I find it to be somewhat unique. The closest thing I can think of in American cultural history, there are two things I can think of. One is kind of the dark, the romantic movement, but that had its dark side of the sorrows of love and all of that, which has influenced the present day goth movement. And the beatniks, who also dressed in black and set themselves apart from mainstream culture, which they also saw as shallow. And other than that, it's not at all like the hippies. It's like the opposite of the hippies. It's not just a way to be a nonconformist. It is definitely proactive towards certain views such as, embracing death, embracing darkness, finding beauty in sadness. There's a lot of artistic and literary, interest, or a lot of people into this have artistic and literary and musical leanings. So it also tends to attract a lot of artistic people.
What are the biggest misconceptions, popular misconceptions, about the goths and goth culture?
I think a couple of the most popular misconceptions would be, number one, that people who are goth are into Satanism. And another misconception would be that they are violent. And I think the Satanism is probably, that idea probably comes from the way they dress. And the violence probably comes from some media misperceptions and labeling certain people goth who are not really typical of goth, such as the two kids who killed the other kids at Columbine.
That was in the news quite a bit. I mean, they had some of the, dark clothes, dark images, obsessions with, or at least an apparent obsession with death and decay. You were saying that's a misconception, that the Columbine shooters did this because they were in goth culture.
Yeah, I don't see anything about them that's goth. I mean, just being in dark clothes doesn't make you goth. There are Wiccans who dress in dark clothes. There are people who just like to dress in dark clothes. They were into heavy industrial music, and they were very fascinated with guns and with violence. I don't know enough about them to analyze them that carefully, but from what I do know about them and their lifestyle and their interests, there's nothing about them that seems goth at all to me.
Where did goth culture begin? Can we trace or draw a line in its history?
You can go all the way back to the original, the Goths who came down from the north and invaded Rome and, sort of brought chaos with them. Now, some of the Goths, people who write about goth culture, mention that as the original Goths. And say that they are, they do not fit into the culture just like those Goths did not fit into the culture. But other than that, there's no parallel. The real origin of it in modern history is the punk subculture that started in working class youth of England as an expression of rebellion against the class structure, against the higher classes, and against the commercialization of music. And the punk movement expressed this with what would be considered then very outrageous dress, with dyed hair and a lot of piercings, torn clothes, and that kind of thing, and then very kind of wild, chaotic music. that they would play usually in these really horrible little dives, because to play for money or fame was to subvert the purpose of music. So there was definitely kind of a political and social expression of the punk subculture. And that, from that came the goth. The goth came out of that from some of the music that was more brooding, not angry, but more brooding. And some of the stuff carried over, such as the piercings and sometimes the dyed hair. You can see some similarities there. But then the goths went more for the black. Whereas the punks were angry, the goths were more brooding and melancholic. The punks were rebellious. The goths are not rebellious. They're just rejecting mainstream culture.
What is the role of music in goth culture?
Well, there were some groups such as Bauhaus that was played in the Bat Cave, a club in London, where this is supposedly the very beginnings of the modern goth subculture. And Susie and the Banshees, The Cure, and some other music that was considered goth. And a lot of the goth music was very haunting and brooding. However, since then, there have been like the industrial music. There are goths who tend to like the industrial music, or who like Marilyn Manson, although a lot of goths disagree with that. And there are other kinds of music now, so it's really hard to say that there's one style of music that's goth anymore. It seems to have diversified a lot in that area.
You mentioned that the goth culture does tend to attract the people with artistic impulses. So talk a bit about the role of poetry, other artistic expressions in the goth culture.
Yes, poetry is very important, and you can find goth poetry on the internet because it's part of that expression of the artistic soul and expression of sadness. I mean, I used to write poetry when I was younger, and usually the motivation for writing is to express something sorrowful or some kind of insight that was very difficult, something that caused pain. And poetry tends to be that way on the whole. And so there is a lot of this goth poetry that you can find, and a lot of the goth people who have written about goth mention this. This is a big part of the goth culture, as well as the music, and probably more the poetry and music than art. But, of course, you know, art plays into it as well, because it's all art. And actually, with the individual goths that I have spoken to in person and through email, the ones who are really into it and really consider themselves authentically goth and not just dabbling or whatever, a lot of them are really into this kind of dark romantic poetry, and some of them will send me emails that have snippets of poetry at the bottom of the email. Or they'll have very kind of poetic, sad names, you know, like Nightbird or something like that. A lot of their names reflect that kind of sorrow. There's sort of this sorrow about life, but it's not like a depressing sorrow as it is kind of embracing the pain of life. So that would be how I would express it.
Now, you know, this is what fascinates me about goth culture. Is not so much the accoutrement of the culture with its music and its look and everything, but the worldview. And what I find intriguing about it, at least the first part of it, is what I think is probably a pretty truthful reaction to what the goths might say is a candy-coated culture.
Exactly, yes. And one goth person told me, I've been to some goth clubs. I started going a few years ago, and at one I ended up sitting at a table with five or six different goths for about 2 or 3 hours. And one of them told me that, you know, I said, why are you goth? Now, these were all, except for one of them, they were all like in their mid, late 20s, and one or two of them were in their early 30s. And he said that, you know, when I look at work, I see people, all they want to do is, on the weekend, they want to go home, drink beer, and watch football. And he said, there's just nothing to talk to them about. It's just all so shallow. But in the goth culture, when I come to places like this and talk to other people like me, you know, we discuss ideas, we discuss philosophy, we discuss literature. you know, and this is what, this is much deeper and more meaningful than going home and drinking beer and watching football. So, I mean, I completely agreed with him on that because I certainly would rather discuss poetry or literature or philosophy than drink beer and watch football. So, you know, there is a certain element in goth culture where they are recognizing that mainstream culture is built a lot on superficial and shallow values. And that is what they're rejecting. And that is also provides an opening for really talking to them about the deeper things, what they think of life. And that provides you some space for sharing your own views. Because talking about Christ is a deep issue, and talking about where you go after death is a deep issue. So there are definitely bridges you can build in conversation to talk to Goths when you're respectful and you take time to listen to them.
Marcia Montenegro is our guest. She's a former astrologist, founder of Cana Christian Answers for the New Age, and author of a cover story in the latest Christian Research Journal. Its subject is our subject during this half hour, The World According to Goth. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's talk with Barry, who's calling from D.C. Barry, welcome.
Hey, Pastor Todd. Thank you so much. Marsh, I have a question. I have a website where one of my pages deals with the suicide of a friend of mine. And I get a huge number of goth sites that link to that and use the picture from that site. What's the fascination with suicide?
That's a good question, Barry. Thank you.
Okay, yes. I think it's because suicide is the ultimate expression of rejection of the culture and the ultimate expression of pain. And it's not so much that they are pro-suicide. One goth writer said, you know, we'd rather pretend to go kill ourselves and then write a really bad poem about it. There's a lot of ironic humor in the goth culture. I do want to point that out. I think it's because suicide is just an expression of that pain, and it's the ultimate rejection of everything and even rejection of yourself. And in some way that is fascinating to goths because in some way they relate to that, to the pain of that. That's my, you know, I'm just giving my own what I'm surmising based on my own experiences and contacts with goth culture. So I don't know if that's really the reason. That's just what I would say.
There is a darker side. I wouldn't want to conclude our conversation without talking about a kind of goth gone bad. And that has to do with the whole vampirism and the fascination with what is, I think, beyond goth, the vampire culture.
Right. Yes, there is a vampire subculture underground. I actually have had an article on my website on that for several years. And that does come from the goth movement. Now, a lot of goths, in fact, probably most goths, reject and they don't like the vampire subculture. They find it extreme or embarrassing. The vampires, on the other hand, tend to think of themselves as the real goths, and the other goths aren't really being the real goths. But there are people who go from a spectrum on this. They go from just playing vampire role-playing games, like maybe on the weekends at certain clubs that host those, to actually getting more involved with it emotionally and psychologically, to actually believing that they are a vampire. And there are different kinds of vampires. Because of my article, I get a lot of emails from them. There are those who believe you have to be born to be a vampire. There are those who believe you have to be initiated. You're initiated by a group of other vampires who have been vampires longer. A lot of them really believe they believe in reincarnation, or they believe that it is possible to attain immortality. Some of them believe in drinking blood, and all the ones that I have gotten emails from have said it's from a voluntary donor. Others don't believe that you have to drink blood to be a vampire. Others are psychic vampires. They say they feed off the energy of people around them. So there's a real variety, and it's a very dark, you know, it is a very dark area. And so a lot of people don't really want to even think about it, but there are people who are into that. And I think that it draws a variety of people. I think it does draw some people who are really emotionally wounded, other people who are just so, they are such an outcast in the culture that that is the only niche for them. Some of them feel that vampirism gives them strength. And I find some of the attitudes in vampirism similar to Satanism in that there is sort of an arrogance or a feeling of superiority to other people. Some vampires don't even think they're human. They think they're beyond human. So there's kind of a variety there. And I did want to mention that there's not one uniform religious view either among the Goths or the vampires. You will find, particularly among the Goths, you will find a lot of agnostics, and then you will find some who identify with Wicca and their Goth Wiccans, and you'll find some who are into Eastern religions or kind of New Agey type beliefs. So you're going to find a variety of beliefs because Goth is not a religion. It's a subculture, a movement in the culture.
You mentioned it, Barry also mentioned it, the use of the Internet by Goth culture, where many people might see it for the first time or might be exposed to kind of its inner workings, that is, its literature, the thoughts, the kind of the organized way of expressing itself. What role does the Internet play in Goth culture?
The Internet definitely is a way for people into this to contact each other. There are several websites, there's quite a few websites that talk about Goth culture where people can post what they think Goth culture is. They can post poetry, etc. So the Internet plays a huge part in it, just as it plays a huge part in other alternative religions or movements such as Wicca. It's a huge gathering place for Goths, and it's where they can reach out to other people, especially if maybe they're in an area like a small town where maybe there aren't a lot of Goths or something, you know, then they can go on the Internet and contact other people that they feel they can relate to.
Marcia, it's predominantly, at least as far as I can see, predominantly a youth culture, a teen culture, or very maybe perhaps young adults, but people seem to outgrow it, and you don't see a lot of graying Goths out there. Am I wrong in my perception?
I think it's more visible as far as the younger set goes, teenagers and young adults. But there are Goths who are in their 30s. Because I get emails from them. A lot of them. I think what happens is that they may discontinue dressing like a Goth either because of maybe work reasons or social reasons. But they still consider themselves Goth because the ultimate Goth is not how you dress, but it's your state of mind, and you're a Goth forever, basically. So you don't have to dress like a Goth. So you may be seeing Goths who don't look like Goths, but I would say there are definitely quite a few in their 30s, even their late 30s, and getting into the early 40s.
So there might be some graying Goths out there.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know if they have gray hair yet, but they might be having it soon. And probably at that stage of life, if you've gotten married and you have children, other concerns, you know, come along, and you can't focus on yourself. I mean, when you're Goth, it's definitely, if you're not married or don't have children, it's something you can get into more because you don't have anybody else to be responsible for, so you are going to see it more visibly with younger people who aren't tied down to certain family responsibilities. And I think, yes, some people do, quote-unquote, outgrow it or just leave it behind, but I do think there are older people who are into it. You just aren't aware of them.
Kathy's calling from St. Charles. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I just had a quick question. I was wondering, does there seem to be an orientation for women to be in the Goths or men, or is it just seem to be equal? I just know when I see them at the mall or when I've seen them, it's mainly women or young women.
Thanks, Kathy.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't ever really thought about that. I would just say offhand, I think it's equal, men and women, or male and female. I think it's pretty much equal.
Well, then, taken as a whole, obviously you have mentioned there are many different varieties and streams, and not one man's Goth is someone else's vampirism in some cases. But the kind of the mainstream of its culture as it expresses itself in the way that the average person would find it, is Goth culture incompatible with Christianity?
Well, that's sort of the question of the day, because there are goth Christians. There's a goth Christian website. They feel that they can be believers and also express their gothness, so to speak. Now, I think, you know, it depends on how you're going to define it. For example, if you look at the suffering Jesus went through on the cross, you know, he was crucified at the place of the skull. That all has kind of, if you look at it from a goth viewpoint, has a lot of goth overtones in it, and there is a sadness about the sin and suffering in the world. And you could look at that with kind of a goth outlook. Of course, I think ultimately, because of the hope we have in Christ, because of the resurrection, of his resurrection and the resurrection we will have to eternal life as believers, you know, there's a hopefulness there that overcomes the darkness and overcomes the sorrow of the typical goth attitude. So in that way, they're not compatible.
I'm thinking about this, given the fact that you're dealing largely with young people who are going to take the life of the mind more seriously, who are going to see the hollowness of pop culture as approaching them in order to start a dialogue or even to witness to them as a Christian. It seems as there's a door open there, especially when you can talk about, you know, Christians do not deny suffering.
Right.
We do not deny pain or sorrow in life. In fact,
right.
We have the most realistic outlook toward these things of all.
Exactly. Yes, and that I definitely think that is a platform to use in talking to people in the goth culture. I think it's definitely something to talk about. Yes, there is suffering in the world. There is a lot of pain. There is sorrow. And you can go a lot of different directions from that. You know, will this ever end? Is there a cure for it? What about Jesus? What was it that he went through? Why did he have to suffer on the cross? What was he suffering for? And that's a way you can talk to someone about Christ. I definitely think in a lot of ways it's easier to talk to a goth about Christ than it is to some other groups.
You can check out the website for Christian Answers for the New Age, Cana, just by going to our website, issuesetc.org. When you click links on the left-hand side of the homepage and scroll down, you'll find a direct link to Marcia Montenegro and to Cana, Christian Answers for the New Age. Our website address again, issuesetc.org. Marcia Montenegro is a former astrologist, founder of Cana, and author of the cover story in the latest Christian research journal titled The World According to Goth. Marcia, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it, Todd.
When we come back, at least according to the reports, the cancer-related deaths among men are down. Good news, right? But the cancer-related deaths among women are up. And the number two cause of cancer-related death is breast cancer. Is there a connection? Why women might be unique in that respect and why their numbers are still going up? Karen Malik will join us after this to answer that question.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.